were any of your formative crushes cartoon characters? Are any of your current crushes cartoon characters? If so, you can come and sit with us terrible people. I'm comedy writer and 42-year-old child Gabby Hutchinson Crouch, and almost all of those many years have been spent with a crush on some cartoon character or another. Why do they appeal so? Let's find out with the help of some funny guests who are here for a talk about the animated characters that trigger an immediate cutscene in their hearts. Will we find something out about early crushes, pop culture and sexuality, or will we just wax lyrical about well-rendered wet shirts? Whatever we do, I hope it'll help you see that that Mario Brothers, M. Craig rabbit hole you keep going down on DeviantArt is absolutely fine. Welcome to Curiously Drawn. You will have noticed that most of the time on this podcast, I'm asking my comedy friends to guess. But for this episode, I asked the host of my favourite radio show, and she bloody well said yes, and I'm really excited. So with me this episode is the host of Radio 3 Sound of Gaming programme, which celebrates the art of video game music on the first Saturday afternoon of every month, and it is brilliant. She's also a technology journalist for BBC Radio Scotland and hosted the first ever gaming prom this year, which I listened to live and then watched on telly while live tweeting. And a bunch of blokes who weren't watching tweeted, I hope they play the theme to this one obscure Spectrum game I played in the 80s as the same rubbish joke over and over again, even though the actual prom genuinely started off with an orchestral rendering of the Spectrum ZX loading tone. It's Louise Blaine.
That's the best intro I've ever had, ever, ever.
Oh, I loved the gaming prom so much. And what I did not love was a bunch of 50-year-old men tweeting me the same joke about how silly they thought it was that there was a gaming prom because they haven't touched a video game in 40 years.
Basically, they were doing a lot of promotion on Radio 3 about the gaming prom, which meant that they kind of shipped me around Radio 3, which was really nice. So I met lots of different people, and I did the Saturday morning record review, which normally they get like a prestigious composer to come on and choose some tracks, but they had me come on and choose my favorite gaming tracks, which meant that I too got a series of very grumpy men tweeting at me on a Saturday morning just after I'd come off live radio saying that I'd sent them to Classic FM. That's it, Radio 3, they've lost some listeners. I'm going to Classic FM because they were calling it rubbish. What is this terrible? It's basically the same thing that I think happened with film music.
Yeah.
Before people took film music seriously.
Yeah.
But it's just taking longer for games because people have this idea that games are Pong and not symphonic orchestra-led masterpieces that can fill the Royal Albert Hall. There's now next year the Grammys on February the 5th have the best video game soundtrack category for the first time. Like, video games have previously won, but only in other categories because they've never had their own dedicated one, but now they have their own and we've got a first slot, which is amazing. So it's really, it is gradually happening, but it's like we've been sitting for 20 years going, yes, finally, thank you. This is not how it has, you know, it's not, Mario's great. Mario has great soundtracks now, but also games are more.
Yeah, just so listen to some Austin Wintory, you lose.
Well, yeah, he's nominated. He's nominated. Yep. And Bear McCreary and Richard Jake. Steph Economou and Christopher Tin.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
That is, it's so good. It's so good. Yeah. And yeah, it's just, if I often think about what would I do if I were hosting, like if I were able to do a games music show, and my theme would definitely be games that have personally made me cry, because I reckon I could fill at least 3-hour-long episodes just that. And even now, listening to, I was trying to get people to play Spiritfarer because I just keep pushing Spiritfarer, and I posted the trailer. And the trailer made me cry. And I'll take your hand and guide you through all the steps one takes to move on to a place, a world unseen to us all, but it's okay.
It's beautiful. It's the Max LL score. But that whole game is just so lovely. And the fact that they, when they were sort of previewing it, they're like, hey, it's this cozy simulator game about death, a cozy management game about death. And you're like, okay, I'm here for this, sure. And then it's just this glorious, and there's a hug button. More games should have a hug button.
Oh, God, yeah. I love games that have got, like, a random nice interaction, but, like, obviously Journey is the main one where you can just bleep at a stranger. And bleeping at a stranger is just such a nice thing to do.
Yeah, it's chirping at people. Or Stray, the one on PS5, has a meow button.
And just a scratch. Like, and a scratch. Yes. I got that immediately. That's one of the... So Stray and Untitled Goose Game are probably the two games that I bought the fastest. I love Stray. I think that's my game of the year.
Oh, it's... Do you know... Oh, it's in my... It's definitely in my top 10. And also just that kind of... It's short. It's beautiful. It's got... I just love the fact that when you meow, like... You can meow at like the CCTV cameras and they nod back. It's just got all those elements that you want to push in games, that you want to push things to see what happens, and it gives you things back. It rewards you for exploring, which is always lovely.
Yeah, it is a beautiful game. I think that is my favourite game of the year. Unless it, did I start playing Stardew? I might have started playing Stardew this year and that just took me over, but that's a whole other podcast.
Yes, 190 hours later for Stardew for me, and it's a whole other thing. It's a whole thing. I built a mayonnaise empire.
And you get into make the dinosaur mayonnaise once you've got dinosaurs, and sort of farming out the dinosaur, go from one dinosaur egg to like incubating them and like creating a whole dinosaur farm. And
me finding a dinosaur egg was probably one of my most stressful things that became like my mission.
Really?
Was suddenly I need a dinosaur egg. And I would pick it up just to fish for dinosaur eggs. That was it. I think I probably did that for about 10 hours before I actually found one. It's the moment of celebration when I finally pulled one out of the water and it wasn't just seaweed. Well, I decided that everyone was too high pressure. So then I became best friends with Krobus. And Krobus has moved in with me.
Oh,
I was like,
lovely.
You know, I just need something platonic. It's fine. I just need, I mean, I'm not going to think about how he smells and like maybe the detritus that he leaves around, because he probably like, Krobus, when you get him out of the sewer, probably oozes somewhat, but it's fine.
Yeah.
It's okay.
I always marry Shane, so I'm not somebody to judge anybody on their personal hygiene. You know, the state of his fucking room.
His beer, so much beer initially.
Oh,
poor guy.
Shane, poor guy. I can't fix you, but never mind. Anyway, we have gone off piste and started like
already.
I made a whole hour long thing about Stardew, so listeners are probably very sick of me going on about Shane, but never mind. So let's go back on piece. I mean, we'll talk about video games, it's fine. So we'll talk about your first choice. Unsurprisingly, for a video game expert, all of these are from video games, and that is fine and valid because video games.
All but one.
You're right. Two of them are
yes.
I messed up. Two of them are video game characters. We're going to start off with a video game character.
Yes.
So your first choice is a Spartan mercenary killer with a tragic backstory, a sword and a broken spear. She uses an eagle to see stuff. She's the Bronze Age badass of Sneaky Sneaky Killy Killy in the most Sneaky Sneaky Killy Killy of the video game franchises. It's Cassandra from Assassin's Creed Odyssey. But here's the thing. Even though I love Sneaky Sneaky Killy Killy in things like Tomb Raider and Uncharted, I have never played Assassin's Creed, and I should. So why don't you tell me about Assassin's Creed and about what you love about it and about what you love about Cassandra?
Assassin's Creed for me is basically the reason that I'm in the job that I'm in. So I started playing, my brother basically handed me Assassin's Creed 2 on PS3 and said, you need to play this. And I thought, oh, okay, I can play a game set in Florence and Venice and all these places, great. But it was transformative in terms of the music, the world, the character of Ezio Auditore. He was basically a Lothario who was running around Renaissance Italy, but his family were murdered and he decided to take on the revenge. And he becomes this kind of Batman-esque character running across the rooftops of these beautiful Italian cities. And I was absolutely lost to it. I was suddenly, this became part of me, and I couldn't, it actually just showed me, it showed me what games could do, that games could be sprawling, amazing cities that I could run across and murder people across and air assassinate. And then the problem being, Ubisoft then went, actually, we're going to release these every single year. And thankfully, they've released less of them now. But there was a period where, you know, I was reviewing and previewing and doing exciting things, flying around the world, just playing Assassin's Creed games, because there was one a year. So we were in ancient Egypt, we were in Unity, which we were in Revolution Paris, Victorian London, all of these things. But then the big, they moved from being open world sandbox games where you were just kind of exploring a city to suddenly being much more of an action RPG where your decisions mattered, and suddenly you had skill trees. And the where that kind of came to a head was with Assassin's Creed Odyssey. So in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, finally for the first time, you could choose your character. So you could choose to play as Alexios, who, or you could choose to play as Cassandra. And Cassandra is actually, going to put this in now, she's the canon character, right? If you look at Ubisoft lore for Assassin's Creed, Cassandra is the right person. But clearly, and with proof, Ubisoft marketing department said, women don't sell video games.
Jesus Christ.
So they added a choice. So you could always play as the boring man option. But why would you play as the boring man option when you can play as Cassandra, who is just this magnificently well-rounded, interesting character who happens to be hot. I could talk for a long time about Cassandra's biceps specifically, and how I chose armor specifically so that she would always show off her biceps. But at the same time, I think it's really important to say that she's hot, but she's also smart and sweet and funny, and someone that I did not, you know, I did certainly not complain about spending hundreds of hours with exploring ancient Greece. So that's basically why I love her, because when she, whether she's speaking in Greek and saying Malacca, which is
Malacca,
Greek for, which is Greek for wanker.
It is the internationally known Greek swear words. I think everybody who knows even passing Greek knows Malacca, which is great.
Well, thank that's only thanks to Odyssey that I know that. And then I interviewed the voice actress who played Melisanthe Mahut, and she was Cassandra, and she did all the mocap for her and she did everything for her, and thankfully I didn't sound too thirsty when I interviewed her. Like I wasn't she was on the phone in Greece somewhere, she's like, oh, you know, we'll just speak for as long as you want, and I'm kind of like mentally going, she sounds just like Cassandra, but she's not. Be careful, she's not actually Cassandra.
You look cute right now, as if nothing can get in your way.
I don't usually like being called cute.
There are a few other ones I can think of that would suit you.
I can't wait to hear them.
How about beautiful? That works even better. The other ones will come later.
I hope later comes soon.
I think having a character who, you know, is multi-dimensional, you know, and when someone that you are, that you spend so much time in, when you play games, when you're running around and occasionally, you know, accidentally set on fire, you know, someone to just spend actual time with. So I love her because she is hot, but I also love her because she's actually a video game character that's got layers.
I like this. I really need to play these games, especially the more narrative ones, because I really enjoy that sort of thing with like the Tomb Raider reboots and Uncharted, especially. I mean, my favourite Uncharted is the Lost Legacy, which should
of course.
Which, I mean, of course, who doesn't want to play as a dumbass Australian hottie? I love Chloe so much. She's just, she manages to be more chaotic than Nate, which is quite a feat. There's one point I really, really love in Uncharted: The Lost Legacy, where the friendship you created with Nadine, and Nadine is, you're having like a mild friendship argument with her, and she says, "Yeah, I'm stuck out here with the sort of person who wears red to go undercover in the jungle." They put my character in red the whole time, which makes her stand out like a sore thumb. And I love
literally
that about Chloe.
A target.
Yeah, I love literally that about Chloe. She just goes, "No, I look good in red. Oh, of course, I'm going to wear red for my." my adventures. She's just a dummy, and I love that. So I mean, yeah, it really does sound like Cassandra would be right up my alley. I really obviously need to play this.
You do, and it's also the first time that, like, so before it was very linear. You were only, you know, you were only doing what they were telling you to do. But this was the first time you could have relationships. And obviously that's right. Such a big part of video games, and also why a lot of people thirst after video game characters, because we then build relationships that we want to. So Cassandra is fully bisexual.
Yes!
She's bisexual though in the way, and I think a lot of people are kind of against this, and the fact that it's like, well, you can just, that everyone just interacts with everyone else. There's technically no sexuality almost, because you can have what you want. Now, I don't mind this, but it's certainly something that I think quite rightly a lot of people are like, well, actually, what if there's just characters who are specifically queer in one direction or the other? But, you know, which way should people go? Like, should you get to someone who, you know, you're playing straight and someone's like, actually, no, I'm not interested in you. That's not what I'm here for. But this, because it was the first time that Assassins had ever done this, just the idea of having these little dialogue options with a heart next to them for everyone means that I know lots of people who basically just happily fucked their way across Greece. You know, I just, you know, my armor fell off for all the hot women of ancient Greece. It was just a joy.
Well, I love a Canon Bi character. I've got a little Canon Bi Klaxon, which I will probably edit in around this point. As a little baby by myself, I do really enjoy it when games just have bisexuality as the default. That's what I love about The Sims.
Absolutely.
So I am certainly not complaining there. I can understand other people's point of view, but as a little baby bi, I'm like, yes, no good.
Yeah, it always surprises me, but I do get it. But also I like the fact that The Sims, if you want now, you can add specific. Yes. That's the thing that they added. Was it? I think it was earlier this year that they added sexuality, because the reason that The Sims had it was it was a bug, wasn't it? They didn't actually design it to have all the characters be able to jump into bed together. But then when they started doing it and everyone really liked it, they were like, "Oh, it's just what The Sims does."
Yeah, I thought I read somewhere that they'd sort of said it's a bug, but there was somebody at the thing going,
I put that in there.
And that they've made, you know, transsexuality has just been a thing. For ages, certainly in The Sims 4, you've been able to have men who can get pregnant and sit down to wee and stuff like that. It's like, no, this guy's just trans. It's fine. You can have kids.
Yeah, it's in The Sims. Good.
Yeah, it's in The Sims. It's all good. Yeah, no, I like that. But yeah, I understand. I also understand the appeal of being able to set your Sim to be like, just gay. That's great. So you also want? Oh yeah, I saw on the wiki, because when I don't really know a character, I just base my entire thing that my little intro for them on the wiki, and it says that she's the biological. Cassandra is the biological daughter of Pythagoras. Is that the triangle guy?
It's that Pythagoras. Oh. You hang out with him a lot in a big cave.
I love Pythagoras. I love, because, you know, I do some horrible histories writing, and Pythagoras comes up a lot because he was mad as a bag of cats.
So this is why you actually need to play all of Assassin's Creed, because they dot all of their historical characters in. And especially in earlier ones, the assassination missions that you take, history can't disprove. You can't prove that these people didn't die in these certain ways.
Sure.
Because they line up the locations, etc. So they're like, well, this person died in this city, and it's like, well, actually it was me, because I sneaked along the chandelier. So it's like, yeah, this is what you'll love. It it's catnip for you.
And it sounds like absolute catnip for me. You're very right. Oh, excellent. So yeah, I like that. I love Pythagoras with his mad cult where they wouldn't eat any beans because he thought beans had the souls of humans in them.
Beans? Is that what he
human
thought?
Human beans. Literally, yeah. He was a triangle guy, but he also ran a cult that was, it was quite popular. It was quite a popular cult. And they were vegetarians, but they were vegetarians who wouldn't eat beans because he believed that the soul of humans was in beans.
Wow. Okay, I bet there's some Pythagoras chat in Assassin's Creed where they mention that and I haven't clocked it because I don't know the bean lore.
I think I think
if you when you play, you need to text me and be like, yeah, look at all this stuff that was in here in plain sight, because you don't know about the beans.
You also wanted to give a little shout out to Randvi from Assassin's Creed Valhalla as an extra. This lady is also hot.
She's super hot. But the thing is, she looks a lot like Cassandra, which is quite confusing. Right. It's quite confusing. But basically, because in Valhalla, you are a Viking, Eivor, again, you can choose. Again, Eivor in female form is the canon character. It's almost like there's a pattern here. and you can choose who you partner up with in your Viking settlement. I partnered up with Randvi. We had this whole romantic thing happened at the top of this tower that we rode out to with the sunset. It was all very nice. But it means that once you've partnered up with her, she hangs out in the war room where you spend a lot of time. You go back to the war room all the time to plan out your next England area of England that you go to. And she's always hanging out there. And I'm always like, there's options for, do you want to look at the map? Or do you want to kiss her? Or do you want to do something else? So basically, like, they don't even take it to the bed. They're just like, yep, right here on the war table. That's it. And I'm not even using that table. I'll be honest, Gabby, I'm not even using that table anymore. Like, it's done. The campaign is finished. After, 103 hours, that campaign, I've got all of England.
Yeah.
I just got to go and check in with Randvi every so often.
Of course.
She'll just be like, hey, how are you? I'll be like, hey, just coming to check in. Yeah, it's part of my... This makes me all sound very thirsty. Does everyone just sound really thirsty when they record this podcast?
Probably, yeah. I mean, that's the point of the podcast, about thirst, so it's fine.
That's
fine. It's all good.
That's fine. I just don't get to do it on Radio 3.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe we should have an episode with just hotties. that will definitely not get the angry men tweeting in. You ruined my Saturday afternoon.
You've sent me to Classic FM again.
Sent me to Classic FM to just listen to The Lark Ascending 20 times
again.
In a row. The Lark Ascending and the theme from The Big Country, just on a loop.
Endlessly. Yeah.
Let's move on to choice two. So your second choice is the flame-haired vigilante who took one look at Batman and went, oh, I could spend my daddy's money to become a gadgeted up cape crusader of the night too. And I'm going to steal his brand. But at this point, she's one of like half a dozen Gotham vigilantes who've nicked Batman's brand. Dick Grayson's got a crush on her, but that former Robin is bang out of luck. She is super gay. It's Catherine Kane, aka Batwoman.
She's super gay. Super, super gay.
But
the reason... So I really... I loved this because back in 2011, or maybe it was 2012, DC basically turned around and were like, okay, we're pressing reset on everything in the DC universe, which was wonderful, right? It meant that you could then kind of pick up somewhere, because I don't know what you're like. If I go into somewhere like Forbidden Planet, I end up being like, oh, all of these characters have new arcs. I don't know where any of them are. But this giant reset was like, okay, brilliant, which meant that I then chose like a select few characters to kind of follow. So I waited until there was the graphic novels of Batwoman, and the first one was called Hydrology. And, I love Batman. I love that world. I love the brooding nature of Gotham. I love the dark. I'm not a Superman fan, not really. Batman is much, much appeals to my angsty sensibilities. So Batwoman, I didn't know anything about, not really. And then suddenly there was just this incredible, beautifully drawn graphic novel about Kate Kane, and it was really multi-layered and interesting. And she was this kind of fascinating, flawed character who kind of created this interesting relationship with Maggie Sawyer, who she then proposed to. And there was just so much going on with her that I just found really interesting, that they were actually interested in creating her character rather than her just beating up goons. Was that she proposed to Maggie, and DC were like, you can't do that. The writers were like, nope, we're leaving. The artist said, nope, we're off. And it went in a different direction. And it was all really sad. But just for that period of time, for those few volumes of graphic novels that I have, like, I have just have this absolute love of Kate Kane and who that character was, and what they were doing with her. And it kind of breaks my heart a bit, the fact that it's just this limited number of books that I can And I loved her and I loved what she was doing and I loved how empowering that felt as well.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, my DC knowledge is much, much sketchy, though. I mean, my Marvel knowledge is really just from the films and the TV series anyway, and my DC knowledge is even sketchier than that. But I do know that sort of DC have tried to bring her to the screen a couple of times now recently, yep. And it's just doesn't seem to be working. And I don't know whether it's that they're not trying particularly hard. I mean, DC just don't seem to be particularly good at bringing their characters to the screen at the moment. They keep rebooting. They keep going, oh, this isn't working after one film. Let's reboot instead of doing what Marvel did and going, no, we're gonna put in 10 years of films and create one story arc and we trust people to get into that. Whereas DC keep going, oh, we've tried this for 5 minutes. Let's stop and start again. And nobody wants to watch the same story 20 times. Did they do a TV show that has now been cancelled and then they tried to do a movie and they just didn't bother?
Yeah, they did the Batwoman TV series, which was Ruby Rose.
I need you to fix his suit.
The suit is literal perfection.
It will be. When it fits a woman.
Bruce Wayne.
Awesome, hilarious, handsome.
You really know that's it, yeah.
And then obviously they made Batgirl, right. And it was really exciting because they shot all of it in Glasgow. They made Glasgow, where I am sitting now in -1, into Gotham. And it made, you know, they closed loads of the city centre, they did those things, because they shot quite a lot of the Batman, the one with Robert Pattinson in it, also in Glasgow. So that end shot, there was that end series in when they're riding through the graveyards on the Bat bike, that was in the Necropolis in Glasgow. So that was really exciting. But then Warner just went, actually, no, we're just going to turn this into a giant tax write-off and this is never going to come out. They shot the whole movie.
I know.
You know, and there's all these contrasting things where people are like, oh, you know, it wasn't good or any of that. And then actually people were saying, we watched it. It was fine. It was fine. Like it was probably like a 3-star movie and it could have got better. And it, you know, shows a hero that we never get to see ever. Yeah. You know, even like the new Gotham Knights doesn't get Batgirl quite right. And we certainly don't get to touch Batwoman ever, especially in games. And they just shelved it. And it's just like, DC, why? Why? Just release it. Surely it can't cost you any more than you've already spent making it. And a whole bundle of people could be excited about a character that we never get to see.
They make such strange decisions. I mean, because they're carrying on with The Flash, aren't they? Even though that star's a massive danger.
Leslie Grace was going to be Batgirl, and that was going to be great. And then she's not problematic. No, she would be. She's inspirational and brilliant. So,
Hollywood, man. Hollywood. At least they did, even though they keep cancelling it, they did at least have the balls to have a properly LGBT+ lead. I'm assuming that Batwoman, as played by Ruby Rose, is gay as hell. Yes. Excellent.
But again,
excellent.
Again, she was gone after, I think, one season. Yeah. And then it was all gone after that. I think they were about to redo it. But I watched the first episode being like, oh, this is cool. And also we had the same leather jacket, which I got quite excited about. And then it kind of petered out for me. It wasn't really what we deserve.
Yeah, it is a shame because, you know, at least they will have like a lesbian lead, because you know the closest we get with Marvel is, because it's all House of Mouse, it's them sort of, they'll very very coyly mention that Loki is bi without actually saying the word bisexual, and then they'll demand a round of applause every time they make a background character say that he has a boyfriend.
Was at the start of Infinity War.
We've got our first openly LGBT+ character, and it's a background man going, I took a man on a date. Thank you, everybody, for our awards for Allies of the Year. And yeah, I got so excited for that crumb of Loki saying that he's bi. Of course he's bi. He's Loki. Like Loki from the Iron Age is pansexual as fuck and also gender fluid, and at one point had sex with a stallion and then gave birth to a horse. Loki is so much more LGBT plus than Disney Loki, who like mentions on a train that he has had the occasional boyfriend. And then Disney go, of course, we're not actually going to give him a boyfriend in the show. That would be too much.
No, that would be too much. You couldn't cut that out in China.
Exactly, exactly. It's all about what they can cut out and redub in the other countries that they were.
Like the kiss from the end of Star Wars.
Did they cut that out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they took that out for global markets.
So getting back to Batwoman and the Bat Gang, because there is about I'm not making this up. It feels like there's about half a dozen bat guys running around Gotham now. I think one of the things I like about I think that sort of adds to their appeal is that the bat guys don't have any superpowers, do they? They're just these guys who go, I'm just going to run around Gotham and sort of mete out justice.
They managed to make it, well, all the villains and then the occasional anti-hero or hero kind of somehow develops some kind of resurrectionary powers. But yeah, I think there's something quite fun about that. And I also think, like, I love how camp Batman stuff can be.
Yeah.
Like I have serious fondness for my favorite one is Batman Forever, the one with Nicole Kidman and Drew Barrymore and Jim Carrey.
I love that
Batman, because Schumacher just kind of understood exactly what was fun about it. And although we've gone back to now the Batman,
Rudy,
we've gone back to the seriousness, it's almost like it's slightly over the top seriousness. It's like it's scored with Nirvana, you know, and it's got eyeliner streaming down his face as he sobs to the sky, you know, like it's like, yes, we know, you know, and you're gonna love this because you know that this is angsty shit that your inner 15-year-old would absolutely fucking love.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm here for Batman in all of its forms.
Yeah.
So that's actually why it's so depressing sometimes when DC hits its, you know, Batflick hitting a tire with a hammer and calling it masculinity. Like, you're like, no thanks, not that. But there is, you know, there are sparks of the DC worlds, like Batwoman, like another Batgirl, that are so attractive still, and the reason that we still love these worlds.
Yeah. Personally, my favourite Batman is the Lego one. And also,
I love it.
I love the Lego Batman. I thought it was really good.
And in game form, I think I platinumed that, one of the Lego Batmans on PlayStation, every single stud. Every stud.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Well done, Lego. I think Lego got the mix of like exciting and also like camp, right?
Yep.
Anyway, that's my tuppence worth. Let us move on to choice three, and it's another hot woman. I don't want, like, no surprises here. I like pointing out when there's a theme to people's choices, and your theme is just hot women who could beat us up.
Sometimes in suits, sometimes not in suits, sometimes in a choice of armor, sometimes in tiny shorts. And the thing was, with this next one, like, I was young, Gabby. This was a lot.
This
was a whole lot of self-discovery.
Well, yeah, I was also young, and this was also one of my little baby bye, oh, that's what that is moments, looking back on
it. So,
yeah. Oh, that's what that was. So choice three is kind of running with the theme. Another absolute badass of a woman. She's posh. She's hard as nails. She'll think nothing of locking her own elderly butler in a walk-in freezer, but that's probably because she's perfectly happy running around in snowy mountain peaks in short shorts and a bomber jacket. So the cold is just not an issue for her. So why should it be for a butler? She's very annoying at speedboat chases, and she'll kill an endangered animal soon as look at it. It's Lara Croft, specifically the original version of Lara Croft from Tomb Raider, particularly Tomb Raider 2. This was my first Tomb Raider game.
Mine too. Mine too. I didn't do the original. This was it.
Yeah. I got. I was given a check for £100 from my uncle, which in the late night in 1999, which for Christmas 1999, which was a big deal in 1999, and I bought myself a PlayStation, not even a PS1, it was just called a PlayStation then, just a grey box. And with it came Tomb Raider 2. And I spent that Christmas holiday with my then boyfriend, now husband, sitting up until about 5 o'clock every morning, just playing Tomb Raider 2. And most of it was trying to get around Venice.
Yes. Yeah, trying to get away from those dogs. There was a lot of dogs in Venice and timed speedboat chases. Yeah, but that was one of our great music, though. Really
brilliant
good
music. Yeah, you great said soundtrack. you put that in a Sound of Gaming. I remember, and you said that listeners of a certain age will be triggered by this, and I absolutely was. just remembering the stress.
I literally added that in just before I recorded it, and I'm going to shout out to everybody that's got PTSD from spending hours in Venice.
Everybody in their early 40s, late 30s, who just spent a significant amount of their teens just trying to get this woman to do a speedboat at a certain speed.
Oh, the thing is, like, I love Tomb Raider 2 because, again, it was my first game. So my brother and I won Christmas. I think it might have been 98 or 99. It certainly wasn't on release year.
Yeah.
Like, we got it for the PlayStation for Christmas. And, again, it was that grey box. It wasn't the adorable little rounded PS1 yet. And it was the one present. So normally we had our Christmas presents were on either side of the fireplace. But
right.
This year, our one big present was in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was PlayStation with Crash Bandicoot and Tomb Raider 2. And that was it. And that was back when all you had were two games and a lot of time.
Yeah.
And we just spent hours playing it together. We would take turns. Mm-hmm. We would spend hours and hours in Croft Manor. We obviously thought there was because there was loads of cheats in it, you know, the step left, step right, to skip levels. And everyone said there was a naked cheat.
A naked one?
Actually,
I heard about this. No.
But you put it in and she exploded. So if you jumped if you jumped forward, you cheated to the next level. If you jumped back, she just went boom.
Oh, amazing.
And that was one that everyone was like, that's how you get her naked. It's like, okay, let's get this pixelated character naked. We're sitting here at 11, I'm 12 at this point. Great. Yeah. And that sadly was not the case. But it was weird at the time because we got the strategy guide, which taught us exactly how to do it. And we spent hours and hours poring over the strategy guide. Mm-hmm. And the strategy guide was not just filled with screenshots, but also, do you remember those weird photo shoot poster girl pictures of Lara Croft?
Yes! Oh my God! And she was
like lounging
wrong.
On it, with a robe on, or just looking at you over her quite strange pink sunglasses.
Yes. Oh, those sunglasses. Yeah. They were so 90s. Yes,
so
I do
confusing.
Remember those. Yeah, it was
confusing.
It was confusing. One of the things I loved about Lara was that, yes, she was sort of, she was hypersexualized, but she also, she dressed sensibly. That's what I loved about her. Because this was at the time where you had the fighting games where the female characters would be doing kickboxing in high heels, and you'd be aware that that's impossible. Lara wore boots, and I really liked that about her. Like she had big stompy, sensible shoes on.
She did have clompy boots. I think it's important to say that her dimensions weren't ideal. Her dimensions were somewhat
she's
unrealistic
Barbie.
Goals, but she did wear the right clothes. But what they did when they reinvented Lara for the 2012 reboot, which was just Tomb Raider, they gave her she wasn't just wearing boots, she was suddenly layered up. She was wearing scarves and outdoor jackets.
Yes.
And she was just layers and layers. And that was the one thing I loved when the new Lara came around. It's like, oh, she's warm. She's the right temperature. This is great. I'm so happy for her.
I did I do really like the newer rebooted Lara Croft games, but I don't fancy reboot Lara Croft. Nope. I just want to protect her because she's so much more human. She has been really humanized. She is much more human than Lara, but also she's 20-ish. And playing the reboot, I was in my 30s and I was like, I just want to mother you. I just want to make sure you're okay. And especially in that first reboot, she's about 21 and she's completely out of her depth. She spends the first act of the game crying.
Help! got to get down.
I love about that first act is so she spends all that time sobbing about how she had to kill a deer and she had to do this, she had to do that, right? By the end of the fucking second act, she's killing everyone. You've learned all these axe moves, you've learned these axe to throat moves, you're shooting guys in the head with your bow before shooting them again with your grenade launcher just to make sure they're dead. She is annihilating dozens of men. It is a joy. I mean, I love the combat in that, but it's just the fact it's like that push-pull of ludonarrative dissonance, isn't it? Where you're literally like, before I was feeling really concerned about you having to murder animals. And now 30, 40 men at a time, people are being thrown with ropes, everyone's exploding. She's not batting one of her pretty little eyelashes. She's just keeping on going. She's got her eyes on the prize, but she's gone on quite the murderous journey. And obviously, even at the end, she gets her double pistols, but she doesn't need them. She's got an axe. She's got a bow. Who needs that?
Yeah, and I love that. Yeah, you get into it as you're going into the game. She'll occasionally just start off by going, "Come on, you bastard!"
She becomes completely furious. Completely, and understandably, because there's that kind of threat of horrible violence, isn't there, in that first act as well, where you're like, "Please don't do this with Lara," but then she takes her revenge. Repeatedly.
Yes, definitely. And it is a shame that they then decided not to go anywhere with Sam, because that first game is so gay. She ends up, she has a sexual offer from a boy and says, "Sorry, I'm not interested." And then she just spends the whole game trying to rescue her pretty female friend. And at one point is carrying her like a fireman, you know, in that fireman's lift. So she Richard Gears her friend. Her friend is covered in flowers because her friend's going to be like the sacrifice. And is just carrying this flower-laden girl across a beach. And you're like, oh, this is a romance. And then for the rest of the franchise so far, Sam doesn't want anything to do with her.
Yeah.
Come on now, guys.
Yeah. I think it would. I guess maybe that would have been too much. Like, not just bringing back Lara and not just covering her in clothes, but also actually making her unavailable to everyone who, you know, we know what happened with The Last of Us, obviously. What happened with The Last of Us Part 2 in terms of reception? Like, even the... I wouldn't say the hint is enough, but it's almost like back in 2012, there was even more kind of, it felt like that was a big, brave move they did.
Yeah.
Putting her in a jumper, I feel.
Yeah.
As bad as it is. And here we are wondering why people aren't legitimizing video games in the way they should.
I mean, the original Lara Croft also felt unavailable, though. I mean, so original Lara gives off massive asexual vibes to me. Mm-hmm. She does not seem sexually interested in anybody. She likes killing extremely endangered creatures.
Yes.
Like, that is a bit of a bummer. Certainly, like, the last dinosaur, I'll kill that. Oh, look, a centaur, I didn't think those existed, I'll kill that. So there's all these sort of marvellous, sort of miraculous creatures, and she just immediately shoots them in the face.
Well, in her defence, like, most of the time they were trying to kill her, but no, she never really tried to kind of maintain them. She could have had like an amazing Lara Zoo at Croft Manor. Do you imagine?
There is that, because we played quite a lot of The Legend or Underworld.
Yes.
And that was at an age where my daughter really liked Tomb Raider games, because again, sort of action Barbie, and she liked that you could play as a girl and you could sort of certainly those earlier levels of that game were quite easy for, I think she was about 9 at the time, to play, and they weren't too scary. But we'd played that bit with the massive octopus over and over again. That octopus wasn't hurting anybody. That octopus was just sitting and being. It was blind, for starters. So, like, she was at a massive advantage. This old, blind, massive octopus just sitting in this underground chamber, and you have to kill it. You can't tempt it away with anything. No, you just have to shoot it a bunch as it just sits there. And I just felt so bad because I love octopi. They're really intelligent. I feel horrible.
I think that's a problem sometimes with lots of games where they're like, you need to kill this thing. You don't have an option. Yeah. You don't have it. You need to kill these people to progress, and you need to kill all of these animals. Like, but then they make it part of the gameplay. I play a lot of Far Cry games because they are open world crack, in the fact that you just have to go around annihilating bases and finding things that you can then level up. It very much plays into my get stuff done loop. So I end up just ticking off, ignoring the main quest and just going and killing them, because it turns out when you kill stuff, you turn them into stuff. So you're like, I'll improve my bow capacity, or I'll add this, or I'll make better trousers, or I'll make... So suddenly you find yourself annihilating the rarest creatures which an island or world you're in just to get a new wallet, which really is... Yeah, it's like, oh, sorry, I see you. You've got great fur. I'll have that. Thanks. Oh, you're really rare. I want you as well.
Yeah, you do that in Red Dead Redemption, don't you? I love Red Dead Redemption 2, and I love the side missions in Red Dead Redemption 2, because the more side missions you do, the longer it takes to realise that Arthur's dying. So I played it through once, and I cried so hard. And then I went back, and I keep playing it, and then stopping when I know I'm going to have to go to that island, because as soon as I'm off the island, Arthur's going to realise that he's dying. I just keep doing like as many side missions. Spoilers to the quite old game that is by Rockstar, who always kills off their protagonists. Surprisingly.
Why is that?
I don't know. And they always kill off their protagonists, before the game is finished, so that you end up spending like several hours. Oh god, after Arthur died in Red Dead Redemption 2, I was crying for so long, for starters. I think that's not the game that made me cry the most. The game that made me cry the most was Rhyme, one of the games that made me cry the most. I was crying for about an hour about Arthur, because I knew it was coming. When you've got like where he's riding off and the music's really sad, that's when I started. He says thank you to his horse, properly going, then when he died, I was just sobbing, and I was still crying when John was fixing the fences. I was just sobbing over my controller going, but John, you're not my real dad. Just mashing buttons to fix a fence. I don't want to do this. But yeah, they always kill off the... I don't know. Where was I? Oh, yeah. So I always end up just killing these like really beautiful snow leopards.
Of course.
To stop a sad man from dying of tuberculosis.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Killing snow leopards. That could go on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I'm killing the snow leopards to stop a man dying of tuberculosis.
To stop a sad cowboy.
It made me cry the most, and I think it was probably Gone Home. Gone Home.
Really? Gone I love Home Gone Home.
Annihilated me.
Really?
From the moment in the third act where you thought something had happened and that was not what had happened, and you had to go to the attic to check if that's what had happened, I was ugly crying. Like ugly crying. I'd started off kind of being a bit teary, and then I realized that my bottom lip was going, and then I realized that my entire chin was going. And then suddenly I realized I was just all out.
I didn't cry at Gone Home. What I love about Gone Home is that it's one story, but it's another story. And the main story that you're finding out, the main story that you're finding out is a happy story. It is a positive story about your family. But there's this hidden story that you're also finding out about ostensibly a ghost that is just so fucking tragic. And a lot of people, you can play the game and not realise what's going on in that second story. You can't play the game and think, oh, I'm just finding out this really happy story about your sister finding acceptance. And yeah, there's this whole other thing going on that I will not spoil. Go and play Gone Home. Okay. It's amazing. It's a very haunted story. That's a sad one. What's the one? Ones that really, Rhyme made me just, I knew what was happening. I worked out what was going on. I worked out kind of what was going on in Rhyme with the robots, because I was going, this feels like this game is taking us through the stages of grief, because the robots one was bargaining. And then I went, oh, hang on, before that we've had denial and anger. And then in the rainy level, I was going, and this feels like depression. Hang on. And by the, sort of halfway through the rainy level, I worked out what was happening and I started crying, and I didn't stop crying until well after the credits.
Yeah. Well, did you, this has just become the From Thirsty to Sad podcast.
Yeah.
Unravel did that to me. Did you play Unravel?
It was too difficult. I tried playing it. It was a bit too difficult for me.
It was tricky.
I'm not great at tricky games.
I reviewed Unravel, and the puzzling with the strings was, there were some testing moments in it. But as that progresses and you're kind of playing the memories of this elderly woman who has made you, and you're exploring her memories, but then it gradually just gets really dark. Oh, so obviously the start of the game is all happy, skippy, flowers, look how beautiful this is. I'm skipping through a handcrafted world, basically like Yoshi. And then it becomes soul-crushingly human, and it explores age and extreme stressful loss, all while you're playing as this red knitted character. And then this, the snow starts to fall, and Yarny will sort of grab himself and shiver a bit. And so, it absolutely, when I even think about it, it upset me in a really good way. That painful human, painful emotional stuff that people don't believe that games can have, and then until they play them and go, this is what you were talking about.
Is that, I was just looking at a screenshot that my son took, because he was really happy about putting razors in the guy's bed. The unpacking game. That tells you a whole story just through unpacking boxes as you're moving house. And I remember just how much I hated the boyfriends, just because he didn't. I know why I hated him. He didn't leave you room to hang your degree up. Made me furious.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because on the surface, people were just like, oh, it's a game about unpacking boxes. How satisfying. Yeah. And it's like, no, it's a game about the things that you grow up and you lose. Even the second, moving up from the child's bedroom up to university and stuff, I started thinking about, like, where is my iPod classic?
The things that you keep
loved,
and the things that you throw away, and the things that you revisit. And it's the revisiting thing was really interesting, because there's a dreidel in the childhood bedroom, and then she has more and more things that are celebrating her faith, and she's rediscovered her faith at some point after splitting up with the boyfriend. But she does keep some things from the boyfriend. She still makes proper coffee like the boyfriend does. She still makes fancy cups of coffee. So even though he was a dick who didn't give you room to hang up your degree, you kept some positive things from that relationship, and that's nice. Anyway, and also that she suffers from chronic pain. My husband didn't realise. He was like, why has she got a walking stick? It's like, she suffers from chronic pain. She's got all these painkillers, and she gets more and more painkillers the more you move. She needs more and more pills. That was just really interesting. I have got so off-piste. I do apologise.
No, this is piste. Video games is piste, right? We've got to stay on video games.
I am going to finish off by asking you one last question, which is that if you were able to make one of your three choices a real person and bring them into the real world, who would you choose, and would you try to romantically pursue whichever badass would probably beat you up?
They're all murderers, Gabby.
Yeah, they're all murderers. Which murderer would you bring into the real world to kill?
Cassandra, cool. Absolutely. Because also Cassandra, actually I won't spoil, but yes, Cassandra exists at all time periods. Good. So actually she has fit in very well in the 21st century as well as ancient Greece. And I'd like to think that, you know, when she's not, and she's killing bad people, right? She's killing Templars, the ones that want to take evil control of us with apples of Eden using alien technology, which is the thing that no one ever talks about with the Assassin's Creed franchise. But yeah, Cassandra.
Good. Lara Croft would just go and murder a tiger and that would be not fun.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, Cassandra and her biceps.
Yay! Louise, before you go, are there any projects you'd like to give a shout out about?
Well, just the continued Sound of Gaming. I don't know when this is going out, but as you said, on the first Saturday of every month, we have an interview with a composer and then celebrate a specific theme. For December, that was turn-based games. So I interviewed Tim Wynn about Marvel's Midnight Suns. For January, for a nice time for January, sort of start of January, we're talking about comedy games. So I'm speaking to Kurt Cope about Mario plus Rabbids Sparks of Hope, which is the latest one that came out on Switch. So we'll be talking about games that make us laugh. So that can
brilliant.
Kind of cancel out the games that make us cry with just the games that can actually make us
love
happy.
A comedy game. I write, as a comedy writer, I keep telling people that one of the best comedy narratives that there is out there is Portal 2. Portal 2 is a genuinely amazing comedy. And it's got like really good comedy talent in it. And the writing is so funny. And I just keep telling this to people who don't play games and they're like, what? And so, no, you don't understand. You have a friendship with a potato and Stephen Merchant's in it. And it's amazing. Brilliant. Louise, thank you ever so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been so much fun.
It has.
Huge thanks to Louise Blaine. For more credits and details, see @curiously_drawn on Twitter.